Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 35, for August 15th, 2011. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This edition of the show is devoted to the game design process. I think many of us routinely consider design issues when we discuss games, but outside of formal presentations at DICE or GDC or other such gatherings, it's fairly rare to hear game designers talk about what they do, how they work, how the design process functions on a spectrum that includes both indie studios and major AAA developers. So this episode, which I'll release in three parts, is all about game designers. And in thinking about how to cover the subject in a way that you'd find interesting, I decided to invite three guests that each occupy different spots on that spectrum. In this first segment, I talk with Manveer Hare, who is senior designer at BioWare, currently working on Mass Effect 3. We discuss the challenges of building a big game with many layers of complexity, both technical and artistic. Manveer discusses the creative culture at BioWare, and he explains the kinds of things he does on a daily basis, and lots of other stuff. If you're a longtime listener to my show, you already know Manveer from previous appearances, and you know that he always has something interesting to say, and this segment is no exception. Later this week, I'll release parts two and three of the show. In part two, a little sneak peek here, I chat with Matthew Burns, founder of indie studio Shade Grown Games, and also currently working as a producer for Microsoft on Halo 4. Matthew's one of the most articulate people I've met in the game industry. He's probably one of the best pure writers around, in my opinion. If you've ever wondered what a producer does, Matthew does a great job of explaining it in our conversation. And he also has some useful advice for anyone who's considering a career in the industry. And finally, in part three, I have a wide-ranging discussion with Jonathan Blow, creator of Braid, one of the most successful indie games ever made, both critically and commercially. We discuss his upcoming game, The Witness, among many other things. As you might expect from John, he never fails to fully engage and share his opinions on pivotal issues related to design and the game industry. I really love chatting with him and grateful that he joined me. So I think you'll enjoy both of these conversations with Matthew and John. And if only I could find a Mark and a Luke, we'd have the books of the gospel covered. but for now, enjoy my conversation with Manveer Hare and stay tuned for parts two and three. They'll appear on BrainyGamer.com and on iTunes. And thanks for listening, everybody. Away we go. I am delighted to welcome Manveer Hare back to the podcast. Manveer is one of my most frequent guests, going all the way back to the beginning of the show and to the early days of my blog. He was one of the first people that suggested that what I was doing was halfway decent and supported me and gave me a lot of encouragement. And I always appreciated that and felt grateful to him about that. And he's just meteoric rise in the industry from the day I met him. And now he's working as a senior designer at BioWare up in Montreal, working on Mass Effect 3. Prior to that, he was lead designer at Raven Software for about four or five years.
Yep.
Yeah. And before that, he worked for a while at Big Huge Games. Welcome, Manveer. It's been too long. That's all I have to say. It's been way too long.
Thanks again for having me, Michael.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I mentioned this in the intro segment to the whole show, and I'll mention it again now. Manveer is obviously working on Mass Effect 3, and I'm not going to ask him any questions about it. And I'm not going to ask him any, you know, it's little tricky questions to tempt him into saying something or whatever. That's sort of not the point of this. So, like I said before, when we were chatting, Manveer, if I go somewhere that you don't want to go, just tell me and we'll avoid it.
Sounds good.
So, first of all, you've been up there in Montreal for about a year, right? You went up there in like September or so?
Yeah, so I've been here for 11 months now. 11 months is a tomorrow, I think. So
okay, so how do you like Montreal? How do you like the new digs?
Absolutely love the city. It's a wonderful city. It's a big city. It's much more my style. I lived in Madison, Wisconsin for 5 years, and that was a city about 200,000. A little more spread out. I think I'm more of a big city guy.
Yeah.
So like that style of just being able to go out and meet people and have friends that maybe aren't people that you just work with, very well suits me. So I'm loving the city. Studio is amazing. So, you know, getting to work on a top tier project is always inspiring and fun and a blast. So absolutely loving living in Montreal.
That's great. Well, you described your move, and I know you had a few hurdles to overcome. I guess anytime you move internationally, you're going to have some
right.
You're pretty much past all that now, right?
Yeah. The only big problem I ever had was my car, like getting all the things sorted to get a license plate. But everything else is pretty smooth. You know, EA took care of everything too, so I pretty much got the easy road of moving to Canada. And Canada is very similar to the U.S.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it doesn't feel that different.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about moving to a new position, and I don't think it matters what sort of industry you're in, there's always a culture shift when you go from one place to another. Every place has its own kind of culture. Was that the case for you? Did you find yourself having to adjust to a new kind of way of being in the workplace with a new, maybe different philosophy?
Sure, yeah. You know, it was a few things. One is, you know, I'm working on a game like Mass Effect 3. There's two other games before it, so you very much feel the need to learn from the people who have been there and done it before so that you understand what the core of the game is about and how to bring whatever you're going to bring to it, but like keep it in that mold.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you said, for like the last year at Raven, I was a lead designer on a project that unfortunately got canceled. But there I was kind of crafting that vision. Here I'm sort of interpreting somebody else's vision and making sure that it fits the series well. And so taking that step back from kind of being at the top of a department to kind of being a senior person, but still having a couple of bosses ahead of you. I wouldn't say a challenge. It was a change. I remember the first week at work, I basically was like, I sat at my desk for 8 hours today. I'm used to being up and running around and talking to designer X and Y about all the different features. And now my job is just to also be one of those designers implementing. So that was one of the bigger things. And then just the way that the problems are solved, though, the level design, the gameplay design. I've been a part of both the level design team for about 6 months, and now I'm part of the gameplay design team, and learning how they approach problems, and then be able to bring my own sort of like, well, here's how I solved the problem like this on a previous project, and this worked really well. So helping improve the own processes of the studio has been really interesting and a fun challenge, but definitely it's different. You have to take a step back and realize you're not the top dog anymore, and
yeah.
You know, be comfortable with that. And you know, thankfully, I have an awesome group of people I work with.
It struck me when I've met people who work there that BioWare seems to be a pretty self-confident company. Not in this, just in the sense that they make good games that people seem to really love, but that they like bringing in people to kind of help them challenge themselves in a way.
Sure,
they're receptive to that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they want to grow at all times, and they want to be an industry leader. We want to be an industry leader, I think, in general. So I think they're willing to challenge the way that that we do things internally all the time, and that includes bringing people from the outside. It's always good to kind of get a mishmash of your own internal ideas and, you know, also bring in some new ideas from the outside to kind of help bolster that up.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I remember when it was just news that you were going to be moving there. And you mentioned, I think you tweeted about the fact that you were just playing the heck out of the BioWare games, especially the Mass Effect games. You were just like really playing them and taking a look at them carefully. And you'd already played them, but you're sort of replaying them.
Sure.
I'm curious, from how would a person in your position, about to enter the position that you're in now, how would that alter the way you play those games? What sort of things did you find yourself looking for? What did you think about as you were playing them or revisiting them?
I was looking at the design of the levels themselves, like how are they creating the combat spaces and how You know, where was cover located, and how, like, what angles could I come from, and what were the little micro choices I could make? You know, can I flank left? Can I flank right? So I was thinking about that strategic level. I was also thinking about high level. Well, how do all the different powers work together with the weapons and the different characters that you can take along, and how do these bolster, and how does it change on the hardest difficulty? And, you know, what are the strategic choices you make and the upgrade paths you make in those RPG systems? Like, how do they all improve your character and your loadout as you go through the game?
Right.
And so it was really just sort of like taking a better critical eye at that stuff, you know, and trying to figure out what is the essence of what you're getting into. I took 2 months off before I started here. So I basically had 2 full months to kind of relax and, you know, get kind of prepared for the job, which was nice.
I would imagine to some degree, I mean, you're looking at something that's very well made, and I'm sure you were thinking, I mean, you're very critical, so you were thinking, like, this could be better, maybe this could be better. But, I mean, in a way, it must have been exciting for you to sort of think, I'm going to be stepping into this world and working with these people who made this game, because it is these are pretty damn fine games.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely. Like, you having worked on games and knowing how much work it takes to make a, you know, even a mediocre game, like, it's just an incredible amount of work, even for that. So to make a top-tiered game, you know, just understanding all the challenges you must go through and to come out, you know, on the high side of quality, there's a lot of things working against you. So I was really looking forward to learning, like, how BioWare does that along the whole path and getting a chance to kind of play the game and saying, well, here's what I could help improve or bring up, you know, when I'm working at the studio. Those are always good things, like, so you can try to help make improvements.
Right. So this is a kind of a big question, but I'm trying to ask it of each of the guests in this little mini series of podcasts, and it has to do with how you describe your job. I mean, what do you spend most of your time thinking about, and what do you spend most of your time doing on a daily basis?
So I primarily implement, like, the classes and the powers for those classes and their progression. So the way I think of my job in a grand scheme is, you know, if someone says, what do you do for a living? I explain I'm a designer on video games. And basically, if the game isn't fun, part of that is my fault, right? Like at the end of the day, my job is to interpret, it's to be an advocate for what the player is going to experience, right? It's not to implement and create the coolest thing that's going to be cool for me to implement. It's to understand who's going to be playing this game, what kind of player they are, and why they like the game and the series. And then create something that'll be fun and interesting and engaging for them, and be an advocate for them at all times. So I always want to make sure that, you know, you're thinking about the player when I'm coming up with new ideas with other people. What I actually do on a day-to-day basis is I implement, you know, different, like, powers in the game and the 6 different classes and balance, work on the balancing of the new powers or what the different upgrades are and how they're going to work, things like that.
So when you think about a game from the point of view of a player, a certain percentage of that is, I guess you would describe it as sort of thinking creatively. You're trying to think of new or better ways or a new angle or a new way of thinking about a power that might already exist. But you're also thinking about, once you've made some progress on it, how to problem solve it, right? Or how to, I mean, I guess I'm asking, is there a balance between thinking creatively and thinking kind of as a problem solver or as a person who's trying to basically make something that already has been created better?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the creativity, that's the fun part, but I think that's actually a smaller part of what the job is. I think the figuring out the problems and, like, where all the holes are, like, there's tons of cool ideas you can come up with, but then when you start going into the details, that's where you find all of the issues. And finding what those issues are ahead of time before you even try and go, well, you know what, this is actually not feasible because of these 5 issues, let's not even bother and spend the time and waste the time and money.
Yeah.
That is a huge part of the problem. I think that's what you see, the biggest difference between senior and junior designers in general, from my experience, is junior designers will come up with some really cool big ideas, and some of them will be even feasible, but they will not have thought about all the depth to that idea in terms of how would you implement it and what are the ramifications of each decision you'll make. A really good senior designer, that they know in general what's probably going to happen. They know the questions to ask, or at least to go, here's the risk. I don't know if this will work out or not, but I know that here's where the risk will be and can make decisions off of that.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot of balance there, but really, I mean, I think most of the job is really just trying to figure out the holes and the problems and how to solve them, and think about what will that do to the player's experience. Not necessarily is that making more fun, but does that player experience feel smooth still? Like maybe even the small things you never think about, like how do I enter and exit menus and how do I change my loadouts and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The things that everyone takes for granted. How do I move around the level? Like, you know, what's the movement options I have?
Right. It's an interesting point you make, because it reminds me of a couple of conversations I've had with artists, visual artists, who I think we maybe create a false dichotomy that we say, well, if you're not being creative, then you're problem solving, and problem solving isn't creative. But in fact, once you have the idea and you're implementing it in whatever it is, it could be, you know, brush strokes on canvas. Once you've started that process, often it really boils down to backing up and saying that's not right. It needs to be better. And that's a certain kind of problem solving. And that actually requires a lot of creativity.
Right. I would say a Rube Goldberg machine is incredibly creative. I imagine 95% of the effort of a Rube Goldberg machine is problem solving, right? Like coming up with this falls into this and that's really cool and fun. I'm sure you spend a decent amount of time on that. But then I've heard and seen people just try and try and try and fix all the problems until they can get it to run.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's sort of like that. Like, I think they're not mutually exclusive. Like they are intertwined. I don't think creativity is just aesthetic or fun, basically. Right. I think creativity involves creatively problem solving an issue.
Right. Another part of that process, I'm guessing, has to do with just interpersonal relationships, right? You've got to be able to work with people.
Sure.
Yeah. So how does BioWare foster that environment? Or do you find yourself responding to, again, sort of back to the culture question, a way of working with your colleagues that serves the way you like to work?
You know, at BioWare specifically, one of the core, values of the studio from, you know, when Ray and Greg started the studio was humility. And what that is never resting on your laurels, never thinking that you're the best, either personally or like your project's the best, right? Like always realizing you can learn more. And everyone up the chain kind of has that sort of attitude, which means that I can go up to a boss and say, hey, I think this can be improved. This isn't good enough for this reason. And vice versa, you know, someone can come to me and give me critique on my stuff. And so we foster a culture of critiquing each other's stuff, and you get tough criticism. But it's something you need to learn as a creative and as a designer and a collaborative medium, that swallow your pride, that no one's attacking you, that they're attacking, like what they're saying is, this is not good enough and here's why I think it's not good enough. And it's up to you to either defend it if you really firmly believe it is, or make adjustments and iterate and find the right thing. That's a hard thing for people to do at times, in general, just at anyone, right? Like no one likes to hear that the thing that you did wasn't good enough, but everyone's really professional at this studio and in the games industry in general, I've encountered, and can kind of handle that. And the people who can handle that are the people who don't really last very long, in my opinion. Yeah. So I think the way we foster create that culture is by just letting anyone criticize any part of the game, as long as it's constructive, and work towards a better game as a result.
I'm smiling as you say this, because anybody who's listened to this show going back to your earlier appearances knows that that's exactly the kind of working environment that you've described way before you ever got the job at BioWare that you like. I remember you saying, I just can't soft, you know, sugarcoat it. I'm going to say, this is what I think. And this is how, you know, I'll try to be polite, but this is just how it is. It sounds to me like you've found the place where that approach is treasured.
Yeah, definitely. I am very blunt as a person, and I don't have time to, you know, go make everything nice and rosy for you if I'm going to give you tough criticism. And that's for the most part, you know, as long as you're not coming out boorish, you know, and like an ass, you know, as long as you're being respectful to people, that's really treasured. So I got very fortunate.
Well, you mentioned Rube Goldberg, and I was thinking, a game like a Mass Effect game is just a mind-boggling number of moving parts and just a huge amount of coordination to get to market. And how does a developer pull off that kind of effort with so many moving parts? I mean, how do you feel when you're working on a day-to-day basis? Are you connected to the bigger picture, or do you not have to think about that so much? it's, I guess I'm asking just how do you work inside a system with such complexity?
It can be challenging. You know, we have two studios, for example, Edmonton and Montreal, kind of working on the game together. And the Edmonton's the bigger studio with more of the leads on it. The Montreal studio is kind of growing. So I don't necessarily know everybody on the team, frankly. Like, I know the design department. I know the animators I work with and the some of the artists I work with. I know everyone in the Montreal studio because we're only 50 on our side. But, you know, I might not know like Sound Guy X or some of the other animators from cinematics and stuff like that. So the way you handle that is there's a few things you have to do as a project. One is show off pieces of the game that maybe everyone else doesn't see. And we have regular meetings, team meetings that we get to show off, you know, here's what this department did and here's what this department did. And I'll sit there, I've never seen this stuff before or heard of this stuff before. And I'm like, wow, that's really amazing. So you get to see what all your colleagues have been working on that you've never had time to see. And then the other part is there's the piece that you own, either own or are working on. And so mine is part of design, right? And that's just making sure I'm constantly communicating with people. I'm actually the only gameplay designer in Montreal, for example. So I have to constantly make sure I'm communicating with the rest of the guys in Edmonton, calling them on VidCon, having chats, looking over stuff. And we do that, you know, to make sure that it's fitting in the grand vision of the game. And then having people who own the vision of the game, making sure they're looking at everyone's stuff and making sure everything kind of fits into what the goals of the game product are. Having that sort of large team, you're never going to see everything. The person at the top can't see everything. They'll see everything like implemented potentially, but they won't necessarily all the pieces that got there. Like no one person can have full visibility on the project. So the way you solve that is by having lots of different responsible people responsible for different things and trusting them and kind of not trying to micromanage them. Mm. You need to let people experience or perform the tasks that you hired them for and trust that they're going to get that stuff done. And you need to be able to redirect them if they're off path, but you don't need to redirect them every, you know, few seconds. You redirect them every few days or weeks or even months if you need to. So it's kind of finding that fine balance of like how often, how much do you abdicate authorship of what you want and let people interpret it? And when do you pull them back and say, no, you're doing it wrong. And here's why, here's where you need to go. Hmm. And it's interesting because at my last job at Raven, we worked on Wolfenstein for many, many years. And at one point, you know, we were up to 100 people and then we kind of rebooted the project. We were down to 20 people. And it was so much easier to handle things when we were 20 people because like we all kind of knew what each other was doing. And that kind of goes away at full production.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's almost like you're making little groups of 20 people all over the place. And you have to make sure all those 20 people are communicating at a high level with each other and it all fits in. That doesn't really answer your question, probably, but so basically, it's a mess. It's like organized chaos. It's like on the edge of anarchy, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. But that's you know, I mean, things flourish in that environment if you've got a few really good producers in place to sort of keep things connected, right? I mean,
yeah, definitely. I think it's really hard to just plan out everything. Like you have to have a plan, but you know, you don't have to follow that plan like word for word. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, the act of actually having a plan, you'll answer a lot of the questions, but you need to understand that, you know, a quarter or a third of things are just going to be wrong or off and you got to start over.
Yeah.
And so being agile in that way is really, really, really important.
One of the misconceptions I think about, well, I don't know if it is a misconception. I'll ask you if it is that, you know, game designers, about all that people understand about game design is there's a thing called crunch and everybody works really hard for a long period of time and then they, you know, sort of come out the end of it and they have to take long vacations and then they all get paid. You know, like this is a very cliched sort of way of thinking. But I follow you, the social networks and stuff a little bit and we, you know, chat occasionally. It seems like you have a full life. You don't sit in the office, you know, for 150 hours a week, you know, constantly grinding away. I mean, maybe that time will come, but I mean, it seems to me that it's possible for the majority of the development time of a game to have a full regular life.
I think it certainly is. I value studios that try to have that balance. I'm fortunate to be at a studio where quality of life is of a high importance. I've heard some stories from Mass Effect 1's development, which did not go as well.
Yeah.
In terms of time, and there was a lot more crunch. I think this being the third game in the series, we kind of know what we're doing and know what our processes are. So we know how to handle those. And again, the studio values the quality of life thing. I will crunch. I've crunched before. June, I worked a lot of extra hours just to make sure I got everything done by a certain deadline, just because I wanted to make sure I got it done. No one was asking me, really. I just personally was like, I really think I should get all of this done by June so we can start evaluating better. Yeah. And that's kind of like a personal crunch almost, right? Like no one's really telling you. That being said, my last job at Raven, there were times where I worked 60 plus hour weeks for almost a year. And I didn't necessarily have that freedom in my life, or I was too tired to have it. And again, that was a lot of my own doing. Like I just pushed myself. But I think having pushed myself to the edge of insanity before one time, I now know where my limits are and when to scale back and go, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I'm not being productive now, I need to go and take a break. Right. Versus, a few years ago, I might have just gone, well, no, more hours is better. The way I've kind of poorly described it to a friend before was like, it's like if you're a college kid and you drink too much, you kind of learn what your limits are for drinking and you realize, okay, maybe I should have a few less beers next time or a few less shots. Like, I think that just comes with having done it once. At least that's the way I learned.
Yes.
The wiser will probably learn without ever having to do that. I am not wise.
One of the things about the game you're working on is that it exists within a very complex structural sort of lore, right? That you have the storytelling involved. It's a narrative game. Does it matter that you have a grasp of all that lore? Have you found yourself becoming interested in knowing what all of these backstories are? Or does that even matter when you're sort of doing what you do?
I'm highly interested in it. I'm a very story-driven player. And I care about all like the different races and things like that. So I want to know as much as possible. At the same time, there's so much that there's no way I could ever know all of that. No, it's like that. Did you ever see the video of that guy in the red shirt who kind of called out the Blizzard guys for having some fact in World of Warcraft wrong from one of the novels? Like that kind of thing happens because somebody else writes a novel, right? And then that story fits in here and someone's broken the canonical, like, what happened in the universe.
Yeah.
Or you say or know the wrong thing. So while I want to know as much as possible, I know for a fact that I don't. I'm not one of the writers. So like day to day, my job is not to know that lore stuff. My job is to implement stuff. And then if I break lore, talk to the writing team and be like, okay, I might have broken something here. How can we solve this creatively? Or what can we do? Or can we create a new thing in the universe that will explain how this all works?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of having trust with those kind of guys. There's like a few guys that are basically like the kings of making sure we are sticking to what the franchise and IP are. And I do not necessarily, they have a tough job. They have a very tough job because when you have hundreds of people working on a project, you're just going to break things by accident. And your goal is to catch as many, if not all of them, before you ship.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, right now as we speak, in fact, in Indianapolis, which is a short drive from where I live, is Gen Con.
And okay.
So speaking of lore, there's, you run into all sorts of people there that are connected to whatever. It could be the Star Wars universe or Mass Effect or whatever, or D&D. But it's always amazed me how much attachment players have to that. And your first glance at it is sort of, well, that's stupid because it's not important or blah, blah, blah. But the more you talk to them, they're not really insane. There's nothing wrong with these people. They just really love the games they're playing and they're invested in them in a way that, from your point of view as a game designer must be, I don't know. I mean, you're providing something that's ongoing. That's almost like a living, breathing thing. You're part of the creative process of that. And there's something pretty cool about that, it seems to me.
Yeah, no, I think it is extremely cool that there's like an entire just this group of fans who are rabid about the franchise that I'm working on. And whatever franchise people are working on, I think that's really cool that people dress up in cosplay for, Comic-Con and write fan fiction. And, they very closely identify. And I think, all of us have done that to an extent, especially like most of us are nerds. I mean, to an extent, like I'm certainly a social nerd, but I'm still a nerd. I might go out, but I also watched a lot of Star Wars growing up and identified with characters and had my favorite stuff and could quote lines from Aliens and stuff like that. So I think it's something we can all understand. And, you know, I think our fans are amazing. And any fan that is that rabid about something, they are amazing. There are a handful, I mean, always, that will take things too far or too literally or get far too upset about something. But that's the price of passion, right? And I'm okay with that at the end of the day. Like, if that's the cost of having something that people love, like, that's a really good problem to have, frankly.
Yeah.
Like, you can only be that lucky. Like, really, that's first world problems, right? Like, that's, like, if that's your problem of the world, great, awesome.
Yeah, yeah. What, in your view, is the most common misperception that people have about game design? The gaming industry, I guess you could say, broadly defined.
It actually probably is off of design. Like, I get a lot of questions like, hey, I have lots of awesome ideas and I want to work in the industry. And, you know, I've had a saying, which is, you know, ideas don't really matter. Execution is what matters. Like, everybody in the industry has ideas. There's tons of us who have lots of awesome ideas for new games and IPs. And there's no shortage of that. The shortage is of people who know how to execute that and execute it well. Because there's been plenty of games that we've read, like, the high-level idea of, and you're like, that is amazing. And you play it, and it's not. And it's because the team couldn't execute for whatever reason. There could have been time restrictions or technology restrictions, or they just didn't fully understand the idea, or the idea was bad. So I think people who think that, A, there's a job for just being an idea guy, that's pretty much wrong, unless you're, like, you know, one of the top people at the company. Even then, they're not just idea guys. They do a lot of other stuff. They may not build the level themselves, but they do a lot of other management and leadership work to enable everybody else to do that.
Right.
And it's too, like, no junior person coming in the industry out of college or something is really going to get that job unless they start their own studio. And if you're starting your own studio, you need to be doing as much as you can of building the game yourself to cut down on costs and, you know, make sure it's the vision that you have.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's usually the thing that I hear the most. I think I've ruined some people's, like, dreams when I've, because I'm very blunt with people about, like, this is not an easy industry. And if you're in it for money, go somewhere else because you can make more money elsewhere, frankly, for doing less work, you know, in software or whatever. And if you think you're just going to be this cool idea guy, you're wrong. You're not.
No.
Like, you're just not. Like 99.9% of the time, that will not happen.
Is it still possible? You described a route that someone might take. Look, just go start your own and go do it. Is it easier to do that or harder to do that now than it was, say, 7 or 8 years ago?
It's got to be way easier. I mean, all the, you know, things like XNA, Unity, the UDK from Unreal, there's all this free stuff that has enabled you to be able to create games, and the barrier of entry is much lower. You know, when I was growing up, the barrier of entry was, like, you can code in C++, which is great. Like, that's not that hard of a language to learn, in my opinion. But, like, you know, guys like John Romero and stuff, like, coded in assembly. Like, I am not freaking smart enough to have ever learned how to code in, like, assembly and do what those guys did. So I was fortunate enough that high-level programming languages existed, you know, when I started working on, like, learning how to make games. And I think the people nowadays growing up, they're fortunate that entire suites that are created to let you just create content and not have to worry about some of the, you know, how to make the renderer work or how the sound system will work, you know, unless you really want to override it. That's really good because you can make some really cool stuff with just that base implementation. And then if you want to take it a step further, you can then, you know, roll your own little extensions or make your own engine off of that. But I think making games is becoming easier and easier in terms of learning how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a real eye opener, this Games Learning and Society conference, and, which is not at all a thing that game designers go to or developers. It's mostly about educators and, you know, just how we might use games as to advance our goals as educators. And there was a session on how to use the Unity engine.
Right.
I was like, seriously? But I mean, we really have reached the point where you can actually bring somebody in who knows what they're doing and do a little workshop for people who are complete novices to sort of say, well, here are some things that are possible and kind of get them going on it. I mean, that would have been unheard of a few years ago.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I remember struggling so much. Like, I took a computer graphics course when I was in college. I didn't know exactly where I wanted to specialize, but graphics always sounded cool because the graphics. Right. everyone knows, you know, John Carmack and Tim Sweeney and those guys are renderers. And then you realize how much math is involved and that you're probably not smart enough. At least that's what I realized. And I was like, I don't think I want to do graphics, actually. I think, you know, yeah, the AI and the gameplay stuff is a lot more interesting. Now you could go to school and never have to know how to make graphics and shaders, frankly, unless that's exactly what you wanted to do. You could just worry about other sets of problems, you know.
Right. Right. You have taken the lead in speaking out about the game industry's historic lack of diversity, not only in terms of characters that appear in games, but, you know, also just as how they're represented in the workforce and otherwise. BioShock, you know, in some ways has taken the lead on this issue. Do you see the issue as improving from when you first started talking about it?
Improving means that we've done anything. And so in that respect, yes. Like, I mean, there's Prototype 2 and Starhawk are coming out. I believe they both have black protagonists in their games themselves. The industry, I don't think the IGDA has done another diversity in the workforce survey in a few years. So I don't know if our actual, in North America specifically, the ethnic backgrounds or even gender backgrounds of the workforce has changed and improved. I think in the indie space, you're seeing, I think the blowing up of the indie space, you're seeing a lot more creators who have their own interesting angle, like Anthropy, I think her name is.
Right.
And people like that who have an interesting idea or background or thoughts on games, making their own little games. So I think there is an improvement on that level. I think in general, though, like across the industry, especially in the AAA space, we're still not making very big strides. Like we're doing little things here and there, but nothing major. I haven't seen a giant thing that's like, holy crap, that's a game changer. That's a big step forward. I'm hoping to see that in the next few years. But you know, as our budgets increase and people become more risk adverse, I'll be honest, I don't necessarily see it happening on its own. I think, you know, developers have to start pushing their publishers for it. I don't think a publisher is ever going to bring this up. And so, like, my rallying call has always been to developers, including myself and the people I work with, which is we have to demand to do a better job of ourselves and of our peers. And if we do that, you know, everybody else will follow once, you know, someone's successful with it.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to hear more and more people are very, very positive about it. So hopefully, you know, we actually start seeing some more improved changes in the industry as a result.
You know, this is a whole separate topic, but, you know, I see these people before you would see them in the sense that they're coming to me out of high school and going into college. And there's a real crisis in American education right now, especially as it relates to educating young men and particularly young men of color. The numbers are just staggering. I mean, you've seen them, I'm sure. It's the college, the high school dropout rate is just mind boggling. And, you know, we've got to figure out how to get students, from the ages of say 12, 13 through 17 to be interested in what we have to offer them in high school, because they're just not.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. You know, and I don't know, I don't think anyone really knows how to solve that problem, but there is far too few women and minorities going into technology fields, and video games is a technology field, even though there's an art side of it that you can get into. And there's just lots of people who don't even think that this is a viable career path, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I've met people, you know, from like inner cities who have basically been like, you make video games? Like, you can do that? And your thought is, well, of course, someone has to make it. But that never crossed their mind, right? They're just like, well, no, I'm playing this game now. No, I'm playing my game now. I never thought about who made it or that I could even be one of those people. Mm. You know, the education system in the U.S. is, in my opinion, broken in so many ways, especially in the cities. You know, like I grew up in Maryland right outside of D.C., but I was fortunate to be in a very like good area and went to a very good school. And, like, you know, I went to the kind of school where everyone went to college. But if you went to DC or you went to Baltimore, you could see the difference of, like, you know, 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 go to college, right? Like most people are dropping out or graduating and going on to careers, or not careers, it's just like, you know, menial jobs. high school level jobs.
Yeah.
And that's always sad.
It is. And I, you know, my son just graduated from high school and he's in that transition period going to college. And, you know, watching him these last few years has just been just incredibly frustrating. Not so much him. I mean, we've had our struggles, I think, just getting him to want to apply himself because it's so uncool to do it. I mean, it's a deeply culturally embedded thing for young men these days. To be smart is just not what you want to be.
Right.
You do not want to be the kid with raising your hand and answering questions and being excited and passionate about your learning. It's at least in the environment that he's in, and so many other environments I see, it's just so uncool to be smart right now.
Right. Yeah. And that's sad, because I think, you know, there are some, you don't have to be a big dweeb to be smart or want to be an intellectual, you know, and I think video games are cool in general. Like, people grow up and they want to play video games. I think we have an industry that can leverage the youth in a way, but I don't think we've found a way to sell ourselves to the youth yet. And no one's taken up that cause as a primary mission. Maybe somebody is. I'm sure there's like small groups that are trying to, but you know, we're going to need it's almost like you need an advocate to kind of sell what your career is. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't have kids and I probably won't for a very long time. So I'm fortunate not to have to deal with that problem for my own like kid growing up or something. But I can't imagine how difficult that is.
Well, you're definitely going to be a cool dad, Manveer. I'll tell you that. You will be the cool dad.
Sure.
So we'll wrap up here. And I assume you still play games. You still find time to play games.
Yeah, definitely.
Do the designers that you work with, people you work with on a day-to-day basis, do you kind of chat about games you're playing? Is there any role that those other games play in your thinking about what you're doing? Or do you sort of sit around the coffee table talking about it?
Definitely. We talk about games all the time. Like, you know, I'll watch a trailer of something that looks really cool and be like, hey, did you guys see this trailer? This looks awesome. And send it out to, you know, a group of designers or people that I know would be interested in the game at work. So we talk games all the time. Like, you know, we're talking about Bastion recently, since I came out a couple weeks ago on Xbox Live Arcade, which is awesome. And anyone who hasn't played it should definitely go buy it and play it.
Yeah.
It plays a role in two ways. One, it's obviously we got in this industry because we love games. So you can never take that away, right? You know, even when you're burnt out, you might not play as many games, but you're still interested in games in general. And on top of that, yeah, you can always learn things from other games. Like, I've run and, you know, checked out the Uncharted 3 beta and the Gears of War 3 beta just to check out, like, hey, how are they doing cover and stuff? Because, you know, I want to improve, help our team improve cover, and we can maybe learn a few things that they're doing just by trying to see how it works and how faster stuff works, and try to deconstruct it into a way that we can potentially roll it into our product. So you see what features other people have to try to stay competitive, or frankly, just take good ideas. Like, there's lots of really good ideas, and they cross-pollinate. And I think that's healthy for the industry that we build upon each other's games. I really love studios like Naughty Dog and, you know, obviously my own studio that go to GDC and things like that and just kind of tell a lot of their secrets away of how they make the game. Like, how, you know, Naughty Dog had great talks a couple years ago on Uncharted 2.
Those were great.
They were amazing. And, like, to me, that just made everybody else understand that. And then now they have to step their game up to improve. But that's kind of good for the whole industry, right? Like, that's how we keep improving. It's kind of like, you know, if we all know how to make that base level, now we're not worrying about solving that base level problem. We're all worrying about solving a cooler, more interesting problem.
Right.
And so I've always found that interesting. So playing new games is good for all of those sorts of things, both the job and just for relaxation and fun.
Yeah. It's a weird kind of relationship, it seems to me, you all have, because you are remarkably generous with each other. And I mean, in a way, you're competitors, but you're not. I mean, a lot of people are going to buy both Mass Effect 3 and Uncharted 3, right? I mean, there's nothing that says I can't buy both games. If one I buy one, I can't buy the other. But you're also very secretive, right? I mean, we obviously, I can't talk to designers who are at work on their projects really about anything at all related to the project.
Yeah, and that I think is that's something I'm not personally a huge fan of, but I don't get to make those rules because I don't have the billions of dollars that, you know, the publishers do. There's kind of this thing of you don't talk about a project before it's announced. Like, you know, you don't announce a project till like a year out before it's due or something like that, and you don't ever get to talk about it beforehand. And I don't necessarily like that, just because I like sharing things. I get it from a business perspective at the same time. And so that's really what it is that they feel like it's going to hurt the business if we give away the farm too early. But for someone like me, I just want to talk about what I'm doing because I'm genuinely excited and interested in what I do. And I want to share that. And then I want to share it in a way that I can learn to maybe avoid some problems that I'm going to head down or get some new cool ideas from other designers.
Yeah.
Designers over beers, we talk about lots of things that, you know, about how to solve things in games and, you know, about the projects we're working on and in generality so that we're not, you know, avoiding our NDAs, but we're still kind of being constructive. And that's always very valuable. I kind of wish we had a more transparent industry, I guess. You know, we don't know the sales numbers of our games publicly like what you do in the box office in Hollywood. You know, you have to use the NDP and stuff like that, which kind of guesses through a lot of different sources. That's not that accurate, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I wish some of those problems were kind of solved.
Yeah. Well, one of these days, we'll have a big, wide-open conversation about Mass Effect 3, and I hope it'll be you and me on the podcast. I'd love to come back and think about all the things that you haven't been able to say today and maybe hear some more stories about how it all happened.
Sure, if I'm allowed to, I would certainly love the opportunity to do that after March when the game is done.
Yeah. Well, again, Manveer, it's just a treat to have you on the show again. It's been way too long, like I said, so welcome back. And best of luck with the game and with everything else. And hope that maybe I can get up in Montreal and see you one of these times. This is a city I've wanted to see for a long time and have never been there.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for having me on. And if you get a chance to come up, please do. I'm actually speaking at the Montreal International Game Summit in November. There's lots of cool people speaking at the conference. So if you or any one of your listeners has a chance to come up to the conference, it's a really good time. And the city's awesome.
All right. Well, thanks again. Take care and talk to you again soon.
Okay. Take care, Michael.